Hi, and welcome to This is True Crime, y'all. I'm going to start out today with a couple of quotes from Donald Henry Gaskins, or Pee Wee Gaskins, autobiography. We're going to start with the second chapter from the end, called A Tally of Death. I make the total to be 31. The 14 bodies that Walter or me led the law to, plus the 17 more that's buried in Sumter, Florence, and Williamsburg counties. I've told enough in this book about them to let the law know what most of them was. I don't aim to do all the law's work for them. They can identify the others by checking on people from the Charleston, Florence, Sumter area who was connected to me and turned up missing between 1970 and 75 and hasn't ever been seen or heard from again. Their bodies are buried behind the tenant house and on the second prospect trail and in the neck. In his final chapter to his book, it says, I read somewhere that the FBI says there's between 50 and 100 killers, just like me, on the loose in America all the time. I think they're wrong. I think there's lots more. It's just that so few of us gets caught. Nobody has any way of knowing how many of us there are. I'm convinced that if I hadn't never done nothing but my coastal kills, they wouldn't never have caught me. They still ain't connected me to a single coastal disappearance. Fact is, if old born-again Walter Neely hadn't rolled on me, I never would have been convicted of any serious murders either. And I would still be out on the streets, taking care of my family and making a good living and being a good citizen without nobody ever being the wiser. But I got no real complaints about my years on earth and the way things turned out. I was born special and fortunate. I am one of the few that truly understands what death and pain are all about. I have a special kind of mind that allows me to give myself permission to kill. Not many men is privileged to live a life as free and pleasured as mine has been. Once you decide to kill, and I don't mean killing some pissant in a bar or two old farts in a holdup. I'm talking about deciding to kill anybody you want, anytime you want, anywhere you want, any way you want. Once you get to that point, you set yourself free to live the best kind of life there is. From then on, you make your own rules. You don't give a fuck anymore what the law says or thinks. You don't fear prison or even execution. Right now, as close as I am to dying in the chair, I feel like I'm already somewhere way beyond death. I wish I could explain it, but words don't say it. A person has to do what I've done to understand what I mean when I say they can't touch me. I have walked the same path as God. By taking lives and making others afraid of me, I become God's equal. Through killing others, I become my own master. Through my own power, I come to my own redemption. Once I seen the miracle light, I didn't never have to again fear or obey the rules of no man or no God. When they put me to death, I'll die remembering the freedom and pleasure of my life. I'll die knowing that there are others coming along to take my place, and most of them won't never get caught. I'll die peaceful, because my name is going to live as long as men have memories, as long as they talk about good and evil, and as long as they read my words of final truth. And he's not wrong, because here we are talking about him decades later. He murdered up to 31 men, women, and children in the most gruesome ways. And spoiler alert, he even murders his own niece and her best friend. Donald Henry Gaskins was born on March 13th, 1933. He weighed a minuscule 4 pounds at birth and was immediately given the name Pee-wee, or Pee-wee Parrot, or Junior Parrot. Pee-wee's mother became pregnant at the age of 14. She had quit school at 12 and started working picking cotton and tobacco on her family's farm. She was lured in by a wealthy neighbor and groomed into sex work. Mr. Gaskins, as he was called, loved to gamble and drink, and he was looking for a girl he could pay to have sex with. When he met Molly, he offered her $1 to have sex with him. To his surprise, she agreed. She would have sex with him several times a week for a flat fee of $1. When the Honorable Mr. Gaskins found out that Molly was pregnant, he gave her $10 a month in support and allowed her to live in a small shack with her baby, kind of as a way of paying her off, I assume. Molly and David's father would have rough sex right in front of their small child. What a real piece of shit. They would ridicule him and push him away when he tried to separate them. Mr. Gaskins wasn't Molly's only lover. She was a sex worker and had many men coming and going throughout the years he lived with her. Most were alcoholics who would abuse Molly and beat and sexually assault her son as well while she watched. Wow, mother of the year. He was teased in school for being so small and coming to school black and blue from getting beaten at home, which is terrible, honestly. I do feel sorry for small baby Pee-wee, but when you hear what this terrible human being has done, I promise you will not feel sorry for him for long. Pee-wee would hide out in the woods instead of going to school, and decided to quit school at only 8 years old. He was sick of the bullies, and even teachers bullied him for not getting along with the other children. In 1943, Molly married Hinnant Hanna, a field worker who treated Pee-wee just as shitty as everyone else had. Molly and Hinnant had 4 more children, 2 sons and 2 daughters. Pee-wee started working at a garage at the age of 12. It was known that he had tinkering skills and loved to fix toys, fans, appliances, and other small items for neighbors. He loved working at the garage and was on his way to becoming a successful mechanic. He was even making good money, which was hard to come by for a farm boy. His stepfather, however, thought this was not worthy work and made him quit and start working in the fields like the rest of his family. By the age of 13, he had a little clique that he ran around with. 2 boys around the same age who had worked for the same mechanic as well, Danny Smith and Henry Marsh. The boys found a small abandoned shack in the woods. They named it the Hideout and spent most of their free time in it. They had given themselves the outstanding nickname of the Trouble Trio and would regularly steal candy and cigarettes, mostly from vending machines, and then go to the Hideout and enjoy the fruits of their labor. The first time the boys got in trouble with their parents, they were hiding behind an outhouse. They had dug a trench behind the ladies' outhouse and were soon caught peeping. They got the crap beat out of them by their parents, but nothing else was done. The old boys will be boys bullshit, I assume. The Hideout is also where they were known to take younger boys to sodomize and assault them. Pee-wee Lee later said of the event, they weren't sad for what they had done, but only sad they had gotten caught. In 1948, at the age of 15, Pee-wee and his dipshit gang, with the help of Danny's dad, would break into homes and pawn or sell items they had stolen. Danny's father was apparently a garbage human being, because instead of pointing the boys in the right direction, he gave them advice on how to be better criminals, and even fenced many of the boys' loot from the home invasions. The trio saved up enough money to buy their own car and would often drive it to Fort Jackson or Columbia to pick up sex workers. But that wouldn't be enough for them. They had to have more. They started discussing what it would be like to have sex with a virgin. and the boys decided that they would start with Henry Marsh's 13-year-old little sister. They discussed it multiple times and did unfortunately follow through. Julie was to be Pee-wee's first victim. In Pee-wee's own words, and I quote, "I told the mechanic I worked for that I needed to work only half a day. The plan was to get the little sister to go along with us to a double feature at the movies, but that was just the ruse to get her alone." And this next part is fucking terrible. "We took Marsha's sister to the hideout instead of the movie. We held her down and took off her clothes." I'm not going to say what he says, but they raped and sodomized her several times. He then goes on to say, "It was like we couldn't get enough. Even though we didn't hit her or do nothing to hurt her, she still cried and begged us to stop. But we just couldn't. It was too good. Ugh. Ugh. We promised her all kinds of money and cleaned her up. And by the time she was washed and dressed, she looked just about the same as when we had started out earlier." Her own brother and his friend for hours. I don't even have words for that. Your own sister? He then says that he took her out for burgers like he's some kind of fucking hero trying to make her feel better, but that she didn't eat much of her food. Really? Of course she didn't eat much of her food. I'm sure she wanted to puke just being next to these two scumbags. She got home and told her mother. Mrs. Marsh came to Gaskin's home while his family was sitting on the porch after supper. She came barreling up into our front yard and skidded right up to the porch steps and stopped. Quote, "She bounced out and grabbed me, and before I could say or do shit, she knocked me aside the head with her fist, and I dropped like a rock, out cold. That lady was big, mean, and strong. When I came to, I was still lying on the ground, and my family had all gone into the house, except for my stepdaddy. He was standing next to me and Marsha's stepdaddy, and Marsh. Marsha's mama was practically standing on top of me. She called me every unchristian kind of name she could think of and punctuated every one of them with a kick to my gut. The next thing I knew, they was dragging me and Marsh to the barn. They stripped Marsh first, roped his ankles together, and threw the rope over a joist and strung him upside down. Then his mom paddles him with a pine wood slat. Soon his ass was bleeding, and then she told his stepdaddy to whoop him with his belt. After just a little while, Marsh's back and legs was a bloody mess. He didn't even move when they let him down. Then it was my turn to be strung up naked. I felt the pine board splitting my butt. Then my stepdaddy stropped me with his belt like I haven't ever been stropped before. I was just about to pass out when I heard Mrs. Marsh scream, 'You goddamn little piece of shit, I gotta cut it off right here and now.' And that's when I realized I had a hard-on. She didn't cut it off, real shame, people, but she did take the belt and hit him in the genitals repeatedly until he too passed out." Pee-wee would state later in his gross book that this was his first experience with violent sex, and he would describe it as being a very fulfilling part of his life. What the heck? Later that year, he would meet a new partner in crime at a different mechanic shop. Walt and Pee-wee would break into houses and steal items to pawn once again, but they weren't very good at it. They were supposed to be breaking into homes that were empty, but they made the mistake of breaking into a house where a teenage girl was at home. This little badass came at the boys with a hatchet when she realized they were trying to burglarize the home. P. Pee-wee wrestled the hatchet from her, hit her in her arm, and even harder in her head. She was knocked out and fell to the ground as the boys fled. Pee-wee was captured shortly thereafter, but Walt got away scot-free. It was at this trial that Pee-wee learned his own name. He learned his name was really Donald Henry Gaskins and not Pee-wee. He had legitimately, up to this point, thought that his God-given name was Pee-wee. Pee-wee was found guilty and sent to the South Carolina Industrial School for Boys in Florence until his 18th birthday, which sounds like absolute hell where the inmates run the asylum. On his very first night at the school for boys, he was approached by Boss Hoss Paws. Paws told Pee-wee that he was now his, that he was his property, and that he was now Boss's sweetheart. He told Pee-wee to be in his bed each night at lights out or there would be problems. Pee-wee did not go to his bed, and the next night, as punishment, he was gang raped by 20 or more people multiple times. After that, Pee-wee complied with everything that Boss told him. He was sodomized every night, and Boss would sell him to other inmates for cigarettes or money or favors. Pee-wee only lasted a year before he decided that he was going to run away. He was joined by 4 other inmates. They only lasted 1 day in the woods before they were picked up by the police. While Pee-wee was handcuffed and detained, he escaped when an officer wasn't looking. He was found 2 days later in his old hideout shack. His punishment was 3 months hard labor, lashes for 30 days, and 3 months of solitary confinement. Although he hated solitary confinement, he was fine with it at the time because he wasn't allowed to be raped every night. As soon as he was out, he was forced right back to being Poss's sweetheart. Poss would even make him wear women's clothes. Once again, Pee-wee took off. This must be like a super secure prison. He ran to an aunt's house where she said she would let him stay as long as he helped around the house and stayed out of trouble. Pee-wee's aunt convinced him to return to the school to finish his sentence. She didn't want him being a convict on the run for his whole life. Oh, girl, I'm sorry to tell ya. As soon as Pee-wee arrived, he was given solitary confinement and hard labor. Each day, the guards would find any reason to give Pee-wee additional lashes. One day, after being punished for no reason by a guard, Pee-wee punched the guard in the face and then again in the testicles. Pee-wee was then sent to the state hospital for a mental evaluation. He was only in the hospital for 1 day when his appendix ruptured and he was sent to an actual hospital. After treatment, Pee-wee was sent back to the reform school and was given light duty for 3 months. Immediately after his light duty ended, the guards and Poss beat and raped Pee-wee every day until he once again ran away. During his time at the reform school, Boss Poss had told him wild tales of working as a traveling carny. So that's what he did. He ran away to be a carny. That's where he met a 13-year-old named Mary. He marries Mary, not sure how that's legal, and the very next day turns himself in once again to finish his sentence. Oh my God, make up your mind. You want in, you want out, you want in, you want out, you want to get married, you want to go back in? Goodness. At 18, Pee-wee was released from reform school. Mary and Pee-wee moved in with Mary's family. He got a job in construction and did side work on the weekends. Mary was soon pregnant. They moved with different family members in Georgetown, South Carolina. Pee-wee would work the cypress swamps for a few months, but then he got an offer he couldn't refuse. A reform schoolmate named Slick. And let me tell you, he's not very slick because he keeps getting caught. Said he had work on a tobacco farm and a house for the family to live in. This sounded like an amazing offer. Well, as you probably guessed, the legitimate work didn't last too long. And soon Slick and Pee-wee began burning down tobacco farms for the insurance money. In 1952, Pee-wee and Mary had a baby girl. That same year, Slick was arrested for arson. He didn't turn in Pee-wee, but he was fired from the farm where he was allowing the family to stay. The new owner let them stay, but that didn't work out either. The new owner's daughter probably should not have teased Pee-wee about the arson. When she told him she knew he was involved in the fires and that she would turn him in at any moment, Pee-wee knocked her upside the head with a hammer. He ran quickly but was picked up a bit later and charged with assault with a deadly weapon with intent to inflict bodily harm and arson for setting the barns on fire. His sentence was 5 years in the South Carolina State Penitentiary in Columbia. When in court for the sentencing, he called the judge a son of a bitch. He was given an extra year for contempt of court. During this stint in prison, he became property of another inmate named Arthur. 6 months he endured sodomizing and beatings by Arthur before deciding to take matters into his own hands. But instead of killing his tormentor, he made a plan to kill the most powerful man in the prison, Hazel Brazell. He gained Brazell's trust and then slit his throat while the man was on the toilet. The prison, somehow, decided that was self-defense, but it really seems ridiculous considering he was on the crapper. He was placed in solitary confinement for 3 months and an additional 3 years was added to his sentence. Arthur was charged as well with conspiracy and manslaughter, and he only received an additional 15 years, which was running concurrent with his life sentence, which apparently wouldn't affect his parole at all. They pled guilty to manslaughter, and that was it. After Pee-wee's stint in solitary confinement, he was given his own sweetheart to sodomize and beat. He would later claim that he, quote, always went easy on the kid, end quote. When he was served with divorce papers in prison, he concocted a crazy scheme and once again escaped prison, only this time it was in garbage barrels. He stole a car from his cousin's gas station and was on his way to see Mary. He was not able to reconcile as he hoped, and he went on his way. The next in a long line of women that he marries was Junie Alice Holden, who was 19. They married even though he was not divorced. He and Junie quickly split and he returned to the carny life. At the carnival, he met a woman whose stage name was Zena from Zanzibar, but her real name was Betty Jean. The pair went to Tennessee, where Pee-wee would get arrested for putting razor blades in a carton of cigarettes and giving them to her brother to aid in his own prison escape. Turns out Betty Jean wasn't very honest because the inmate she was trying to help escape was not her brother, but it was her damn husband, y'all. Oh, so after the thwarted escape plans, Betty Jean leaves Pee-wee in a hotel room, steals his car, and gets the hell out of Dodge. Police tracked him to the hotel and found he was a fugitive who had escaped and was sentenced to 6 months in prison, this time in Cooksville, Tennessee. Then he was extradited back to Columbia. Pee-wee was charged with interstate auto theft and tried in federal court this time and was sentenced to 3 years in a federal prison in Atlanta, Georgia. Here he stole a knife from the kitchen and cut a prisoner's ear off to prove his status and that he wasn't to be messed with. During this stint in prison, he became friends with the godfather of the New York Genovese crime family, Frank Costello. Frank called him his little hatchet man and was soon taken under his wings. Pee-wee was released in 1961 and went back to South Carolina and remarried for a umpteenth number of times, this time to 18-year-old Jerry Dolores. And I bet you're wondering, dear listener, if we're ever going to get into his murders. And I assure you, we are. Gaskins met a man named Reverend George E. Todd and his traveling ministry. Todd asked if he would assist him, and Pee-wee agreed. Now, the fact that Pee-wee was doing the Lord's work didn't keep his nose clean. As they would travel around, he would spend his days preaching the good book and gospel, and his nights breaking into homes to steal valuables to sell. Many people suspected that Reverend Todd knew or even assisted Pee-wee in his breaking and entering. But Gaskins had this to say about the preacher. Quote, "Preacher Todd was and still is a God-fearing and honest man who supported his preaching with them donations of goods, which he sold to keep us going to the next preaching place. The fact that I worked for him don't in no way imply that he ever knew or even had the slightest idea what I was doing." The two worked together for over 2 years and eventually parted ways. When Gaskins got back home, he set his creep city level to max and became infatuated with the 12-year-old girl he had known all of his life. He went to her house, talked his way in, then proceeded to tell her about his time in prison, the girl he cut with the hatchet, the girl he hit over the head with the hammer, and the people he murdered in prison. She was getting more terrified by the second, and then started crying. And this is Gaskins' version. Quote, "I put my hand on her shoulder and steered her to the bedroom and said, 'Take off your clothes and lie down there and spread your legs open and I won't hurt you.'" Does this man honestly think that he's not hurting these women? Like, he can't think that, right? He says a lot of very disgusting things about the rape and assault that I'm going to leave this out, honestly. He did say, quote, "That was the best piece of virgin ass I've ever had before or since in my whole life." God, that makes me sick. As the poor girl is lying there too scared to move, and Gaskins is lying there reveling in what he had done, he hears a car. Knowing her two aunts are bound to be home, he forces her to get dressed, and they escape out of the window. The aunts are immediately alarmed when they come home to a missing 12-year-old, a room showing a violent struggle, and blood and semen-stained sheets. They asked neighbors if anyone had seen anything, and Gaskins was soon identified as being the creep everyone had seen at her front door. Gaskins takes the girl to his house, and within minutes, the lawmen arrive. He hides Patsy behind a chiffon robe, but thankfully, Gaskins' stepfather spotted her skirt sticking out from behind it, and Gaskins was arrested. He was charged with statutory rape and carnal knowledge of a child, and was remanded once again to the Florence County Jail. Now, this guy is a freaking escape artist, y'all. He is slicker than whale shit, because once again, he escapes. A deputy takes off the handcuffs so he can speak to his lawyer. He pulls a friggin' Ted Bundy-esque move and jumps out of the damn courthouse window. Apparently, he's part feline because it makes it safely to the ground. And it's 30 feet, y'all. Now, I've researched how many stories that would be, and it's kind of all over the place. But it is above 2 stories and more likely closer to 3. He then jumps in a car, a county car, which had the keys in it. Oof, someone's in trouble for that. The friggin' cojones on this guy. He hightails it to his mom's house, where she gives him money to get out of town, and boom, he's gone once again. As usual, he'll steal cars and marry young girls while on the run. He He ends up in Raleigh, where he meets his fourth wife, if you're counting, Lenny Oxendine. They were married for 3 short months when Pee-wee went out for a pack of smokes and never came back. He runs back to one of his previous wives, and she shacks up with him again. No questions asked. This is the same woman he was with when he was arrested for the statutory rape. Pee-wee and his wife decide that they're going to look up Boss Paws Hoss, who had by this time been released from jail and was traveling as a carny again. The two soon found out that Paws' wife and 4 kids had perished in a trailer fire. Paws had committed suicide in the funeral home with a gun on top of his wife's coffin. Jerry had actually smartened up a bit after hearing this news and told him she couldn't be with a wanted man. That's okay, though, because he had been thinking about returning to one of his other wives anyway. As the pair were crossing the Georgia state line, a trooper attempted to pull him over for the stolen vehicle. A police chase ensues, but Pee-wee would be apprehended after one of his tires blows out and he crashes into a marsh. Jerry was in the car at the time, and even though Pee-wee made his getaway, Jerry was caught. He somehow escaped the police again and hopped in a freight train car and was soon in Savannah. Instead of staying put, he got a bus ticket and a change of clothes and went right back to North Carolina. He showed up on Lenny's doorstep, who was shocked to see him. According to the news, he was a murderer, and it was widely reported that they thought he had drowned in the marsh where the crash occurred. Jerry was held but then released without any charges. Lenny was trying to figure out just exactly what she should do. She let him stay the night while she tried to figure it out. Well, she put her mind to it and she decided the next morning, and she called the local sheriff, and he was arrested without incident and extradited back to Florence. He was sentenced and kept in custody this time. Amazing. His sentence was 2 years for the escape and 6 years for the statutory rape. So now he's back on his home turf and in jail again and using his previous incarcerations as proof that he was a tough guy and went right back to his powerful status in the Department of Corrections. Pee-wee went right back to the top of the food chain. He was even so well-liked by the guards and the warden that the warden himself, Willis McDougald, wrote to the parole board and asked them to release Pee-wee on good behavior. He stated that he believed in rehabilitation and not incarceration. Excuse me, then why are you the warden of a prison? He vowed that Pee-wee was a changed man. I can't believe he believes this horseshit. He was paroled after 4 years and wasn't allowed to step foot in Florence for at least 2 years. Yeah, he's real good at following rules, so I'm sure that's gonna work out, y'all. Pee-wee is released on parole and has an actual job doing roofing. But, as usual, he's repainting stolen cars and robbing people blind. He gets some teenage accomplices to help with a robbery when they turn their knives on Pee-wee and rob him as well as the home they were in. If that ain't karma, I don't know what is. Well, Pee-wee wasn't going to let that slide, and he couldn't exactly go to the police. So he waits for the brothers at their home with a loaded gun, kidnaps them, and takes them out to a nearby wooded area. They think they're going to be murdered. Pee-wee robs them, takes their clothes, and leaves them in the middle of nowhere with a warning if they ever double-cross him again, they would be dead. By now, it's 1968, and Pee-wee is complaining of having, quote, bothersome pains that start in his testicles and course up to his spine, stomach, and then into his head, finally settling behind his eyes. This migraine would be accompanied by a voice that would tell him to harm others. When he heard the voice and had his migraines and, quote, bothersome pains, he would cruise the coastal highways around Myrtle Beach and look for young girls hitchhiking alone. He would later say, I was looking for something special on them intercoastal highways. I just didn't know what it was. He would fantasize about picking up the girls and propositioning them. He would give them a ride if they would pay with sexual favors. If they said no, he would kidnap, rape, and torture them until he had his feel, and execute them so they wouldn't be able to identify him. After refusing to listen to the voice for so long, he decided to indulge himself and give in. In 1969, he would commit his first murder, and it would be gruesome. He picked up a young blonde in Pawleys Island, South Carolina, and is known for being a summer resort and tourist destination. During the drive, Gaskins became angry with the young girl for laughing at him when he propositioned her for sex. This is going to be quite graphic, so I'm giving you a heads up like I normally do. Quote, I slammed my fist into the side of her head and knocked her against the dash. I hit her twice more and she fell to the floorboard. She didn't move. I took off her belt and used it to tie her hands behind her back. I took off my belt and looped it around her neck. Then I looked at her again and remembered something one of the three wise men from Elizabeth Street once said. Killers don't get caught if bodies don't get found. I drove down the dirt road a quarter mile to where it dead-ended at what had been a logger's turnaround, where they dragged felled trees and sawed them to load on the flatbeds. There was a sawdust mound and a rusted pulley and hoist chain. She was getting over being stunned, and I could see she was trying to figure out what was happening and what she ought to do. I opened the car door, grabbed the end of the neck belt, and pulled her out the driver's side. She landed on the ground on her back. Every time she yelled, I jerked the belt and she choked and sputtered. But she kept on yelling and trying to get up. Finally, I reached under the car seat, pulled out my zipper case, and took out my knife. I put the tip of the blade barely inside the nostril of her nose and told her to shut the fuck up. She got real quiet, real quick. Then I ripped off her shirt. All I could think about was what I could do anything I wanted to her. I opened the car trunk and threw her clothes inside. Then I undressed. Then he made her give him oral sex. A minute or two was all he wanted. Quote, I could get a blowjob any time. This was going to be something special. Then he pinches her nipple between his thumb and left finger, pulled it away from her chest as hard as he could, and sliced off an inch of her breast with the nipple. This is fucking terrifying. And again, quote, she screamed. I pulled the belt and choked her quiet. Then I held the nipple between my front teeth and smiled. Blood from it dripped on her face. She was sobbing like a baby. I said, don't cry, I'll share it. And I put the nipple between her lips and told her to suck it. When she did, I shoved the whole slice in her mouth and made her chew it up and swallow it. Oh. She gagged and tried to get up, then she vomited all over herself and me, which truly pissed me off, because there just weren't no call for that. Gaskin then stands up and stomps on her pubic bone as hard as he could, and says that he wished he hadn't have already taken off his boots. Then he sodomizes her while she's crying. It hurts. Please stop. Then he tightens the belt around her neck to make it hurt even more. By then it was late afternoon and I knew I had best move fast. I decided to wait and kill her where I buried her, like they had told me was the best way. I sure didn't want to spend hours cleaning my car. Blood is damn hard to shampoo out of upholstery. I tied her shirt around her chest to soak up the blood from her sliced off nipple. She had trouble trying to stand up. She kept moaning and crying. I put the knife on the car seat and picked her up gentle and laid her inside the car trunk. I told her that if she kept quiet and didn't give me no trouble, I would let her live. She said, "Thank you." I once read in a book about the Nazi death camps that the best way to get somebody to cooperate when you plan on killing them is to promise them that if they do what you tell them to do, they won't die. And you can take my word for it. It works. I closed her up in the trunk, got dressed, and walked to the shack. Picked up the rusted pulley and chain and put them in the car. South of Georgetown, I stopped at a country store gas station and spoke just loud enough for her to hear me. And I told her I was buying gas and for her to please stay quiet. There wasn't a sound from the trunk while I put in $3 worth of high test and went into the store to buy a 50-foot length of clothesline. Then I drove further down the coast to where the marshes come close to the highway, and they're thick with sawgrasses and swamp plants. I pulled her out of the trunk. She was having trouble breathing, but that didn't matter much anymore. I watched her watching me. She whined. Her eyes was pleading with me not to kill her. I said, "Beg, bitch." Then I left her laying on the ground while I walked back along the trail until I found a tree limb about 6 feet long and drug it to the edge of the water. She was laying on her side. I tied her knees together and looped the rope around her neck and drew her knees up to her chin. I made more turns around her neck, tightened the rope, and knotted it. She was doubled over, trussed for butchering, her head and legs on one end, her vagina on the other. And this is very horrific, and I'm not going to say exactly what he said about it, but as she was tied up and helpless, he took out his 11-inch knife, put it inside her all the way to the handle, and sliced upward. This guy is fucking sick. Quote, she twisted and jerked, trying to scream. I wanted real bad to take off her gags so I could hear her, but I would have had to be crazy to do that. End quote, you're already fucking insane. Always weigh bodies down heavy. I remembered what they said and roped the logging chain and pulley around her. Then I dragged her to the water, draped her across the pine limb, floated it out as far as I could reach, and dumped her off. I watched until she had sunk so deep there weren't no trace of her, and she didn't make bubbles for very long. End quote. Pee-wee then puts her duffel bag in the trunk with her clothes, steals money out of her wallet, there was a $20 bill and 6 ones, ruffles through her belongings, and finds an additional $300. He said there was identification, but he can't remember her name. It was Leela or Lila or something like that. When asked if he could identify her, he said, "I'm not sure. That was a lot of years ago and a lot of bodies ago. And frankly, I didn't give a flying fuck who she was or where she came from. I felt truly the best I've ever remembered feeling in my whole life. All the bothersomeness inside me had sank into the marsh with that girl, and from then on, whenever the pain came back, I knowed what to do to get rid of it." And that, my dear listeners, I think is enough for this episode. Keep in mind, this is one of his first murders, and we have several more to go. It's gonna be a doozy, like a real terrible fucking doozy. But I hope you'll stay with me and stay tuned. The next episode will be released tomorrow. And thanks for listening.